The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Well, hello again. This is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we wish to thank them for their generous support. And we're reading from the combined April-May edition of Smithsonian. We're going to run out of space here. This is Hot Type Makes News, the last of its kind, a small-town newspaper in Colorado is still slugging it out. Slug is a newspaper term back before all the computerization. This is by Nick Yetto. Photos by Rob Hammer. And there's a piece of lead that has the masthead for the newspaper. The Seguache Crescent's masthead is cast from lead in a process that allows it to survive a year of printing. A mechanical ruckus, oiled metal clattering hard and loose. A room astounding in its clutter, alive with spinning gears, reciprocating arms, rattling chains, a single man at the controls coaxing the steampunk contraption along. It's publishing as an athletic art, all the more impressive for its medieval roots. It's just what I know, so there's no point in changing, says Dean Combs, the man running the machine. Combs, age 70, is publisher and editor of the Seguache Crescent, the weekly for Seguache, Colorado, a hamlet of around 500 souls high in the Rocky Mountains. The Crescent goes to press every Tuesday. It costs 35 cents at the local gas station and town thrift store, and you can snag a copy for free at the 4th Street Diner and Bakery. An annual subscription can go for as little as $16. There are 360 subscribers. Each week, Combs produces 400 or more copies using a Mergenthaler Model 14, which his family purchased new in 1920. It's the last linotype-produced newspaper in the United States, and perhaps the world. For the better part of the 20th century, newspapers everywhere were printed on linotype. The machine was devised in the 1880s by a German-American inventor named Otmar Mergenthaler. It revolutionized publishing. Previously, newspapers and books were typeset by hand, letter by letter, word by word, line by line, using the 15th century technology developed by the German printer and inventor Johann Gutenberg. The linotype mechanized this tedious job by allowing a lone operator to compose, yes, lines of type. The operator sits at a typewriter-style keyboard with each keystroke a small brass mold for a single character, a capital B, for instance, releases from an overhead magazine, slides down a chute, and goes clinking into place, like a quarter in a coin sorter. Once a lineup of molds is complete, the operator throws a lever and injects them with molten metal, forging the line of type as a reusable slug. The lead slugs are taken to a separate station, clamped in a frame, and put through a roller to create the one-page press plate used for printing. Mergenthaler's invention ushered in the modern print age. Thomas Edison called it the eighth wonder of the world, and Mergenthaler became known as a second Gutenberg. By the 1970s, though, the machine was obsolete, replaced by the great eradicator of skilled labor, the computer. The Crescent, launched in 1882 as the Seguache Advance, has been produced in the same building since 1902. Combs' maternal grandparents purchased the newspaper in 1917, and it has remained in the family for three generations. His mother, Marie, worked at the paper as a little girl and continued until she was about 80, setting type and writing feature stories. His father, Ivan, ran plant operations. When Dean was a baby, his parents hooked his carriage to the back of the press to rock him to sleep. He started working at the paper at the age of 12. Combs' father labored hard each week on the Crescent, but also made money working jobs throughout the region, from farming to carpentry, and in 1968, Ivan and Marie considered selling the newspaper. A local man was interested in buying, and Combs' parents indulged fantasies of leisure. Leisure time and travel. I was pretty upset about this, recalls Dean. As should be obvious, I'm not one of those people who likes change. Beyond that, Combs feels a commitment to his neighbors, the community that has depended on the Crescent to bring them the news of the day. Regina Schwartz declares for treasurer. Clips from the clerk. Study club meets. A newspaper is not an easy thing to get out of, Combs says. I have one guy who prepaid his subscription for 7 years. What would I do? Call him and give him his money back? If something breaks, Combs fixes it. No one's ever worked on a 100-year-old linotype. It's uncharted ground. There are little things I don't even know what they do. I just know that they can't be loose. Bill Hazard, 65, is a lifelong Saguache resident, a retired school teacher, unofficial local historian, and custodian of the town graveyard. I just marvel at how well he keeps that thing running, Hazard says. While newspapers run on deadlines, finicky old contraptions keep their own schedules. An untimely malfunction can have Combs up all night, scrambling for a fix. In such moments, his patience can meet its limit. You can't have a sledgehammer around the thing, he admits. He'd be too tempted to use it in moments of frustration. Combs has been running the paper ever since his father died of a heart attack in 1978. The family produced that week's paper the following day. In the four decades since, Combs has missed only one day of work because of food poisoning. He has no children and isn't training a replacement. When he retires or dies, the Crescent and the Art of Linotype will go with him. To hand the paper off, I'd have to say, you'll never go anywhere. There will be no vacations. That's not the way people want to live. Combs gives a good-humored sigh, edged with exhaustion. Apparently, it doesn't bother me. Combs notes at least one person who could step into the shop and take over the machine without any training. Unfortunately, that person is Johann Gutenberg. Everything that Gutenberg did, how he would have handled his type, he could walk into the Crescent and know what was going on. A hearty laugh punctuates his sentence. If he wasn't, you know, startled to death about being alive 500 years later. That was a good story. Up next, Paris on the Potomac. The American visionaries rebuilding part of Notre Dame using 12th century tools. The roof of Notre Dame de Paris was still burning in April 2019 when Rick and Laura Brown got a call from their daughter, Ryan, a documentary filmmaker and professor at Oberlin College. This sounds like a project for you, she said. Let us think on it, Rick replied, which usually means yes. The Browns are at the forefront of a field called experimental archaeology, recreating ancient objects using the tools and techniques of those eras. Their main goal is education, teaching their students at the Massachusetts College of Art and Design to recreate age-old monuments, and more. The object itself is loaded with information, Rick says. You don't understand it until you reverse engineer it and experience the process. The couple met while studying sculpture at the University of Georgia in the early 1970s. After graduating, they bounced around the country and academia, eventually settling in Boston. Fascinated by New England's architectural history, they joined the Timber Framers Guild, a 1,400-member group devoted to the old-fashioned craft of building structures with beams and joints held together by wooden pegs. In 1998, Grig Mullen Jr., a civil engineer and retired professor at the university, rather at the Virginia Military Institute, who has worked with the Browns since their earliest projects, put out a call for volunteers to recreate a full-size medieval trebuchet, a kind of catapult, and the period's most fearsome weapon. The Browns took part in the workshop, and on the flight back to Boston, Rick sat next to PBS Nova producer Michael Barnes, who asked Rick if he thought he could recruit timber framers from the workshop to help assemble more weapons for a Nova program. Secrets of Lost Empires. The show culminated with participants raising two full-size trebuchets, trebuchets, next to a castle on the shores of Loch Ness in Scotland. Other historical questions followed. How did medieval craftsmen lift the enormous stones used to build castles? Working off old manuscripts and illustrations, the Browns collaborated with timber framers from the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Czech Republic to build human-powered cranes consisting of timbers, ropes, pulleys, and wooden hamster wheels big enough for a person to walk in. The Browns also helped build another crane to make repairs on the 14th century Tostnik Castle outside Prague, which sits on a plateau too small for today's mechanized cranes. The Browns' longest undertaking involved the, I'm not even going to pronounce this one, synagogue spelled G-W-O-Z-D-Z-I-E-C, built by Polish Jews in the 1650s and destroyed by Nazis in the 1940s. Through their nonprofit organization, Hans House Studio, the Browns assembled teams of carpenters, students, and volunteers to build a replica of the synagogue's timber frame roof. On the underside, they recreated its painted ceiling, exuberantly decorated with Hebrew letters, animals, and vibrant geometric designs, using paints they'd made, similar to those used by the original painters in the 17th century. Along the way, the Browns transported the ceiling panels to seven different cities in Poland, inviting Polish students to join the painting team. By the time the roof was finished in 2014, more than 300 students, carpenters, and artists had taken part. The result was permanently installed at the Poland Museum of History of Polish Jews in Warsaw. It's more than recovering an object, Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimblett, program director of the Jewish Historical Institute of Poland, said of the project in a 2014 documentary, It's a Recovering World. The burning of the Notre Dame Cathedral in April 2019 inspired the Browns and their students to launch a new international educational project. After two-thirds of the cathedral's roof and most of its spires were consumed by flames, Carpenters Without Borders, a French group, held that the structure should be rebuilt using medieval methods, an argument the group eventually won. The Browns offered to help demonstrate the potential of experimental archaeology in this singular case, a gesture of goodwill and solidarity. In response, the French carpenters sent them the plans for Truss 6, a supporting structure that hung over the choir. Estimated to have been built in 1180, the truss was one of the oldest features of a cathedral that took nearly 2 centuries to build, starting in 1163. The School of Architecture and Planning at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., agreed to host the project as a part of a summer course. In May 2021, Mez Welch, a member of the Timber Framers Guild, got permission from Virginia landowners to chop down some white oak trees and drag them out with horses. In late July and early August, several dozen timber framers and students gathered to fashion the truss. The lawn next to the university's basilica became a pre-industrial work site. Workers stood lengthwise along the 40-foot-long tree trunks lying horizontal across wooden supports, and the team scored wedge-shaped perforations into the sides with a felling axe, a heavy-headed tool with a blade ideal for cutting cross-grain into wood. Once they completed that job, the workers pivoted and chopped along the length of the trunk, chipping away the wood between the wedged openings to create a flat surface. For this task, they used axes, some beveled on one side and flat on the other. Thus, a team of humans did the work of a sawmill, transforming a raw trunk into a rough-hewn wooden beam. Next, the volunteers used chisels and small axes and saws to create the joinery that would hold the notched timbers together. Hollowed out boxes called mortises and tenons, the wooden plugs that would fit into those boxes. Some of the workers' children pitched in, helping their parents use clamps and draw knives to shave the pieces to the correct dimension. The worksite was quiet. There were no roaring engines, no screaming saws, no percussive cracks of air-powered nail guns, just the chuck-chuck of axes and the murmur of conversation. On the 10th day, dozens of people stood alongside the beams and began to line up all the joints, following the crew chief's instructions. The workers used muscle power, mallets, ropes, and winches to pull the pieces together, then sealed the deal by banging wooden bolts called clavettes into place with mallets. It was as if they were assembling a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle, where each piece weighed hundreds of pounds, and all the pieces had to fit together simultaneously. Finally, the time came to hoist the finished triangular truss upright. The crew assembled 2 24-foot-tall timber A-frames and fastened them to the base of the triangle. The truss weighed 4 tons and would stand 36 feet tall once the beam hoisted it gently to the sky. Hoisting it too forcefully would cause it to topple forward. Another danger, attaching the hoist ropes to the wrong point on the triangle, could cause the structure to buckle and the pieces that held it together to pop apart. It's basically a sophomore-level course in engineering, Mullen said. Slowly, the huge triangle began to rise. After 10 minutes, it stood upright, held in place by heavy ropes fastened to the ground on each side. The youngest team member, 20-year-old Nevin Carling, shimmied up the truss and tied a piece of evergreen, called a wetting brush, wetting, W-E-T-T-I-N-G, brush, to the top, a tradition thought to have originated in pre-Christian Scandinavia that gives thanks to the forest for providing the trees. When Carpenters Without Borders received the photos, Francois Calame, The group's founder responded, "Formidable." He called the truss an extraordinary gesture for us in France and the grand tradition of friendship between our countries. Some participants found themselves reflecting on another connection between the human ingenuity that gave rise to medieval cathedrals and the religious awe that inspired them. While the truss was still flat on the ground, Cardinal Wilton Gregory, the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., walked onto the worksite, donned a hard hat, and said a Hail Mary, invoking the saint for whom the French cathedral had been named. Then he joined the crew on the hoisting rope and pulled. 2 days later, the crew disassembled the truss and erected it in the lobby of the National Building Museum in Washington, where it wowed visitors for nearly 2 months. It spent March 2021 at the Millennium Gate Museum in Atlanta. It's too early to say if the truss will ever travel to Paris as part of the reconstruction, but the Browns hold out hope. Some of us have compared this to when France gave America the Statue of Liberty, says Rick, and this would be a gift back to the French. Great story that was. I wish I had known about it. Would have tried to go see it. Up next, National Treasure, Mother Country. Patsy Cline sported a homemade suit as spectacular as her voice. On January 21, 1957, Patsy Cline made her national television debut on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which aired Monday nights on CBS. The show featured agents and managers from across the country presenting the latest artists they'd signed. Cline's mother, Hilda Hensley, had pretended to be her manager to secure them a spot at the taping in New York City. Cline was 25 years old and nervous. If she didn't get a break soon, she might have to kiss the country music goodbye. She had grown up singing in the choir of her Baptist church in Winchester, Virginia, and in 1955 had traveled to Nashville to record a few songs for Four Star Records, which later leased the tracks to Decca. But after a decade of hustling, including a few appearances on the Grand Ole Opry, and countless nights singing at juke joints and on WINC local radio station, Cline still hadn't found traction in the industry. By all accounts, Cline and her mother were extremely close. Hilda had been just 16 when Patsy was born, and Patsy's father, Samuel Hensley, had abandoned the family when she was just a teenager. Together, Hilda and Patsy managed to support themselves. Patsy also had a younger brother, Samuel Jr., and a younger sister, Sylvia May. In 1953, Patsy married Gerald Cline, but by 1956, they were separated. And would divorce the following year. It had been a long road to that CBS soundstage. That January evening, Cline enchanted the nation with a deep, steady performance of Walkin' After Midnight, which she had recorded the previous year. Cline didn't really care for the song, but the audience responded so enthusiastically that it nearly broke the studio's applause-o-meter. "Don't go away, Patsy, honey," Godfrey said after Cline had finished. "You done won this." Decca scrambled to release the song as a proper single. A few weeks later, it was Cline's first hit, rising to number 2 on the country chart and number 12 on the pop chart. It went on to sell more than 1 million copies. Country music was then in a state of transition. Rock and roll had come to dominate the charts, and songs that sounded too traditional, anything with too much pedal steel or fiddle, or too many lyrics about family and God, felt hopelessly old-fashioned. Beginning in the mid-1950s, the guitarist and record producer Chet Atkins had helped engineer the so-called Nashville sound, which smoothed out country music's rougher edges, relying on backing vocals meticulous orchestration, and glossy production. Atkins was a divisive figure. Purists accused him of neutering the genre, but his efforts kept country music commercially relevant, creating space for pop-leaning artists such as Klein. As the genre achieved new success, country musicians dressed in ever more flamboyant outfits, glitzy, often self-reverential costumes had been an important part of the country music scene since at least the 1940s, when guitarist and yodeler Gene Autry began sporting a 10-gallon Stetson, igniting a craze for cowboy gear. Yet, as country turned more pop, appearing on stage in some sort of glittering, extravagantly embellished outfit became even more vital, especially for a new singer desperate to make a name for herself. The whole country was moving in a sequin direction. In the late 1940s, Ukrainian immigrant named Nudy Khan, born in Kyiv in 1902, had begun sewing elaborate garments out of his garage in Los Angeles and selling them to showgirls and Hollywood actors, including country singer-turned-Western star Roy Rogers. Khan's suits were gloriously ostentatious, with rhinestones, fringe, and leather patchwork. No degree of ornamentation was too absurd, and nudie suits became de rigueur for country stars. Elvis Presley appeared in an extraordinary gold lame nudie suit for the cover of his 1959 album, 50,000 Elvis Fans Can't Be Wrong. That was the name of the album. Presley supposedly paid $2,500 for the piece. The idea was to stand out on a crowded stage full of orchestra members and backing vocalists to convey unequivocally that a star was in the room. In 1958, inspired by the glitz of Nudie's famous suit, Klein's mother made her a pink ensemble sporting record-shaped wool patches with the names of her daughter's singles spelled out in pink rhinestones. Come On In on the left shoulder, Poor Man's Roses on the right shoulder, Stop the World on the left leg, Yes, I Understand on the right leg, and finally, Walkin' After Midnight on the back. Klein wore it often, including the following year in the parade for her hometown's annual Shenandoah Apple Blossom Festival. Hilda's creation is as spectacular as any nudie suit, perhaps more beautiful for its handmade flourishes. The lilt of Hilda's stitching, the black piping, you can imagine Hilda beaming as she worked on the costume. Love is evident in every stitch. It shines brighter than any rhinestone. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. I know I sure did. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. This program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Call us if you have any comments or questions at 919-832-5138.